on the Sunday panel today. Linda Clark. Morena, Linda. Not yet. Richard Harmon. We've got Richard. Good morning, Richard.
Morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you. And Linda will be up to join you presently. Richard runs and writes the Politic website, and Linda's a partner with Denton's Kensington Swan. Richard, New Zealand's the only OECD member state with no community transmission of COVID for more than 28 days, but Nick Wilson, Otago University's public health professor, staggered that we're also the only country left with a pandemic control plan that doesn't include wearing masks in public. We're hearing about Melbourne. Looking at Melbourne, where the resurgent high numbers began with a leakage out of quarantine, it's reckoned, and given the breakout in Hamilton on Friday night, how are you feeling, Richard, about our chances from here on in?
Well, firstly, on the breakout, I mean, that's the first one we've seen for over a week. So it does appear that this military takeover of the isolation facilities is working. And as long as that works, you would think that we should be okay.
Diplomats and consular staff exempt from quarantine. How do you feel about that?
Well, obviously, it's inconsistent. But there is a very important principle at stake here, which is the importance of diplomatic immunity and reciprocity. And basically, you give what you want to get in diplomatic immunity. Our diplomats do serve in some difficult places overseas, potential trouble spots. There have been incidents where our diplomats have got themselves into all sorts of trouble. And indeed, a guy I was at university with, Chris Smitherman, got punched when he was in the New Zealand mission in Moscow, possibly by a KGB agent, and eventually died of the injuries that he succumbed. Mm. So what you the whole principle that that diplomats are immune from the law is very important.
Linda Clark's joined us now. Morena, Linda.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you as well. Winston Peters, can I ask you both about this, arranging a trip to Antarctica for two women who are friends, or a woman who's a friend of his socially and her daughter. What do we think about this? Linda, you first. Can we see any benefits accruing here?
Well, we haven't seen any yet, have we? This is one of those curious stories that involved Winston that crop up from time to time where we really never get to the bottom of it. And I'm not particularly optimistic we'll get to the bottom of this one, actually. It doesn't look tidy, as we say. It seems bizarre. Who wouldn't want to go to the Antarctic? I just wish that I'd been a better friend of Winston.
Bee-Lin Chu, Richard, said she wondered whether Mr. Peters was motivated to send her on the trip in the hope she would contribute funding to the project, but she says she was never asked for money, which is quite a subtle approach, Richard.
Yeah, well, she's certainly got enough to be able to give the money. She's a member of the Quek family, who are one of the richest in Malaysia and Singapore, which is really saying something. They own what used to be Brierley's, which is now called Guaco Leisure, which owns hotels and property developments all over the world. In New Zealand, they own, amidst other things, the CDL hotel chain, which owns the Millennium and Copthorne hotels. The family are close friends of Philip Burden, who is a close friend of Winston Peters. Who knows what nudge-nudges went on here, what wink-winks went on here, but I would have a fairly heavy suspicion that this was not just a tourist trip, but where the gratitude, to whom the gratitude was expressed, I have no idea.
Is it a bit like the Saudi sheep deal, in a sense? You hope for a kind of osmosis effect through goodwill. Do you reckon that ever works?
Well, it didn't with the Saudi sheep deal, as we all know. But like this Antarctic trip, the true story of the Saudi sheep deal, if in fact we ever got to the bottom of it, took an awful long time to play out. These kind of stories are very difficult. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to get under the hood of these things and to see exactly why somebody, the politician in this case, would be so motivated as to suggest these people go, or in Murray McCulley's case, to come up with this crazy idea of setting up a sheep farm in Saudi Arabia. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't work. The one good thing about New Zealand, well, it's not the one good thing, there's many good things, but one of the good things about New Zealand's political system is because we're so small, these kind of events do tend to bubble up sooner or later. And voters can take can use the information that they can get in the public domain to make their own decisions about the politicians that are involved in these kind of activities.
Linda Clark, Richard Harman with us. Asked by MediaWorks this past week in the wake of the Andrew Falloon scandal if she had received anything about Labor ministers or Labor MPs, Judith Collins replied, "I have, actually." Richard, that was a felicitous question to have asked Judith Collins.
No, wasn't it? I don't believe it was a stab in the dark. They were obviously tipped off.
John Key says he does not have a strong view on whether Labor MP Ian Lees-Galloway should have been sacked for having an affair with a staffer. These things are always very, very difficult, he said. Do you both agree it was a line call, which that implies? Linda?
Not when you're the workplace relations minister. And I think that's the thing that did Mr. Lees-Galloway in, frankly. It just isn't, take it out of the political realm for a moment, and it's just not acceptable in 2020 in any workplace for a boss to have a relationship with somebody who reports to him, unless there's some equivalence in the positions, which there usually isn't when there's a reporting line, or that relationship has been essentially called in. So, you know, the boss, to use that word, will actually go and tell somebody else, you know, the chief executive or the board chair or someone, disclose the relationship. And that's just good practice these days. It's just what people expect. It wasn't always that way, and I know you'll ask us about the past. It was very different, but it isn't different now. If he'd disclosed the relationship to the Prime Minister, he wouldn't have found himself in such difficulties, but he didn't. And the reason he didn't is probably pretty obvious, that he probably didn't disclose it to his wife, but we don't know that. But I think because of the position he had and because he didn't do the right thing, irrespective of the affair, you know, on one hand, who cares about that, he had to go.
Equivalence in the positions, and what you describe as very tidy, of course, and sensible, but of course human nature isn't always as tidy. The equivalence in the positions, the power imbalance, Richard, because that was cited a lot, need there be a power imbalance? What do you think?
Well, I am pretty sure there's more to the Lees-Galloway story than we've heard so far. I think the point's been made by a number of people in Parliament that if the issue was simply a question of him being workplace relations minister and therefore having an affair, then you strip workplace relations from him. He's in fact been drummed out of Parliament. Now that's pretty heavy. And if there was more to this, if he used his ministerial role to secure some preferment for this his girlfriend, then I think that's a very, very serious matter. And that is not so much a matter of power imbalance, but more a matter of power exploitation. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen. And nothing is going to sort of set off jealousies and rumours as much as that. And there are strong suggestions that something like that might have happened in this case.
Although, of course,
in this case, the Paris trip would have been enough to set off tongues wagging among the woman's colleagues and to set up jealousies and poor feeling. Because, I mean, again, it's a bit like Antarctica, isn't it? Who wouldn't, I mean, not in the current circumstances, but who wouldn't want a few days in Paris with somebody that they like a lot? Now, if in fact the minister didn't pay for the woman while he was in Paris, if the taxpayer paid, then you've got a problem. You've got a much bigger problem. And as Richard said, they're looking at that now. And if there were other favours given, then he's got a real problem. And that may be the case. But on the information that we have at the moment, we don't know that. I don't think that he needed to have given extra favours other than the affair itself to lose his job. And I think he wasn't so much, I mean, I'm perfectly happy to be corrected on this, but my impression is he wasn't so much driven from Parliament as he chose to go. And I actually think that was the most sensible thing that he's done for a long time, because he was so and would have been so damaged from this that there was no coming back.
Okay, we are in the realms of conjecture, I should point out. Just to extrapolate from Ian Lees-Galloway's particular case and talk more generally, because it's a topic of conversation that has been around the country over the last few days, when does consensual become inappropriate? Because there, you would think there nearly always is with politicians or anyone outranking you or even with a more forceful personality than you, etc., a power imbalance. So what is the inappropriate criterion?
Oh, thanks, Richard. Well, it's suitable that a female answers that question, I suppose, because, you know, one of the common themes with all of these cases that we've been talking about in the last few weeks is, you know, the problem here isn't anything but men. I mean, these are men making these poor decisions. Consent, if you don't understand what consent is by the time you're an MP, then you shouldn't be an MP. It's that simple. And I don't think there's any complication understanding when there's a power imbalance. Every woman who has been is in a relationship, any kind of relationship, with somebody who has less power than that person that she's working with or living with or getting along with understands that there's a power imbalance. It's completely obvious.
Okay.
But if you're the man and or you're the woman and you're in a position of power, you can't use your power improperly against other people. And likewise, if you've got a forceful personality, some would say I have one, you can't use your forceful personality in an improper way against other people.
All right, thank you. I will ask Richard this. What is it about political life that produces explosions lacking wisdom on a higher per capita rate, it would seem, than in the general populace, or is it only that we hear about the politicians and not everybody else?
Well, there is a bit of that, but look, I think what we are seeing is quite an explosion of immature politicians. Now, when I started out political reporting, which was a long, long time ago, most politicians had already led successful lives, whether they were Labour or National. They will have done other things and before they got into Parliament. And I mean, if you take, for example, the Longy years, David Longy had been a successful district court lawyer before he came to Parliament. But what we're seeing more and more are people who have very little life experience. Look, there's pictures around this morning of Judith Collins with the National Party's Palmerston North candidate, who wasn't even old enough to vote when he was selected as the candidate. And I really think the parties have got to ask themselves this question, whether people in their 20s are really old enough to come to Parliament. Some are, and some do very well, but a lot are not. And what is in common about many of these stories, not Ian Lees-Galloway, but many of the others, is that the MPs concerned came to Parliament at a relatively young age.
Yeah, Todd Barclay, 27 in 2017, Jamie Lee Ross, 32 back in 2018, Hamish Walker, 35, Andrew Falloon, 37. So that's the kind of common denominator you're seeing.
Yeah, well, no, actually...
It shows you, doesn't it, Richard, that they're not... I mean, I think you're right on this point, and I think that in the days of Longy and so forth, because there were a lot of old Tuskers around when a young MP came in, then you had a higher chance of finding a mentor and essentially being trained. And it does require a training. It is the sort of place where it is, an apprenticeship is really required to get the measure of Parliament and how to conduct yourself. And I do think those young MPs coming in now, because they come in larger number, much harder for them to get that kind of training.
Absolutely. And I think, again, looking at National, I spoke this week to a former National Chief Whip and a former Chief of Staff who both made the point that the National Party on Wednesday nights has a highly formalised system where they split off into groups denominated by the year they entered Parliament and host each other and host these groups host themselves for drinks. And so that meant that in the case of Andrew Falloon, for example, he on Wednesday night drank only with MPs who'd come into Parliament in 2017. Now, they're not going to have the chutzpah to to dob him in for his drinking. One of them talked to him about it, but the old days where MPs, journalists and civil servants, everybody, all got together in public drinking in a Bellamy's bar, I think was a much better way to conduct drinking in Parliament than having small groups hive off behind security card access only doors with their colleagues.
It was all out in the open. Richard Harman.
It wasn't really. I mean, you're being a bit rose-tinted about that. I remember when I first went to Parliament in 1987 as a very young woman, I was just profoundly shocked by Parliament's drinking and the fact that when we had the party for the press gallery, security guards came and put black plastic all over the floor and the walls so that damage wasn't done by all of the alcohol and the stamping and whatever. I mean, that was just... I mean, the amount of drinking in Parliament is... In the older days, is absolutely staggering. So there's nothing new about that. Parliament has always had a drinking culture. But I just think that the rest of the community has moved on a lot, and that's why those in Parliament that haven't been able to move with the times have found themselves in strife.
The black plastic was put all over the walls of what? Of which room?
It was called the Doige Room in those days. Richard will remember it more than me, but they used to put black, heavy black plastic all over the floors and up the first part of the walls when the parties were held.
Good Lord.
I think that actually only happened once or twice that I can remember, because, I mean, certainly didn't happen when I was chair of the gallery.
you had a firm hand. Richard had a very firm hand.
I think it did happen. I thought it was canvas, actually, back in the Muldoon years. I think it happened.
No, it was definitely black plastic, because when you wore stilettos, they went through it. I can remember it quite clearly.
Maybe it was because they knew you were coming, Linda.
I'll change the subject, charging people in quarantine. Now, the Prime Minister warned it might happen. She said the government was moving quickly on it. National said, if elected, it will happen. Megan Woods said it's encouraging to see National come out and talk about something the government's been considering for a couple of weeks. And then it became a rod to beat the National Party with. Does this make sense, this debate? And what would the two of you suggest for people returning to New Zealand?
I can't understand why they don't do it. They've done it in New South Wales. They've done it in Queensland. They can trim it and provide finance for people who can't afford it, etc. It just seems to me something that they should just get on with. Megan Woods was talking about doing it about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Nothing seems to have happened.
Linda, a fair way of charging returnees, is there one?
Oh, look, I think they're going to have to be charged, but I think the backlash from New Zealanders who don't want to pay it has been very interesting. And there's a whole lot of colours and shades of that. They're going to have a system whereby you can pay it off, I suppose, because, you know, some of those people coming won't have the money. And that's going to add complication in how you track it down and chase it. But overall, there's going to have to be some charge sooner or later, I would have imagined.
Okay. Last quick question at 9:01, not really giving you time to answer, but I'll mention it anyway. Winston Peters on the disintegrating coalition, away with the fairies, the wealth tax policy, woke fairy dust, an experience of cabinet and so on. It is unseemly. It's, of course, political season. What do both of you think about this happening, though?
I think Winston, for the first time, really, looks frayed. And I've always put my money on the fact that he would come back, but I'm not sure this time it's going to work. I think his negativity is getting the better of him, and it's very unattractive, and voters, I don't think, will like it.
All right, Richard.
Yeah, look, I agree with Linda entirely. I think he's looking jaded. He at his conference last weekend, he only appeared twice, once to do a press conference at the beginning, and otherwise for a fairly lacklustre rally on the Sunday and another press conference, and that was it. And he said nothing new, and as Linda said, he's just essentially totally negative these days.
Richard Harman, Linda Clark, our Sunday panel, thanks to them for their company.